Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, we are really thrilled to have special guest Ernie Gygax with us. Welcome to the show, Ernie.
Welcome, Dan. Welcome, Paul. It's good to see you.
Great
Thank
to have
you for
on the
having
show.
Us in your house today.
Yeah.
So obviously, Ernie has been... So obviously, everybody knows who you are, but I'll just say, so Ernie's been really fundamental to the growth and evolution of D&D. And so, Ernie, you and I are around the same age, and, you know, you and D&D grew up together, I think. And I was seeing online here the line that I really love, that you literally cut your first tooth on an Avalon Hill Panzer Division. I love that. So, so you and I first communicated because we were co-judges of the one-page dungeon contest back, I think, about 6 years ago, which was, I think you and I agree, a whole heck of a lot of reading.
Yeah, a lot of reading, but there were about, say, 20 great dungeons, or layouts, one-page dungeons.
Yeah, there were. Like, I think we got, what were we going, like, through 60 or something like that? And that's exactly what I did, is I came up with, like, a top 20 myself. So that was about the high-quality count, you're right.
Right. I think it was 100, but it was too many. Okay.
It was too many. I feel like I got a PhD in dungeon analysis from that.
It's a great resource, honestly. I still recommend that to folks when they're like, oh, I need a quick dungeon. I say, go look up the annals of, because it ran for many years. Maybe it's still going on. I don't know. But great material.
Yeah, I got to admit, I think they burn through judges every year because
once
you do it once, I don't think anybody's done it twice.
I declined.
Oh, okay. Like, I love D&D and I love all things D&D. It was like, that's enough. Oh, wow. So Ernie, there's a couple of things in classic D&D that Paul and I still like to run that apparently you specifically came up with. I guess the Cone of Cold spell and the fact that haste ages people. And, you know, something really fundamental is the fact that different classes have different hit dice. So you were fundamental to that switch?
I'm afraid in all those cases, just because my father was always trying to even out the game so that there wouldn't be a distinct advantage for being a magic user or an elf or whatever these mid-maxes that everybody does, because as a young man, I was always looking to get the edge and to get the most items, to get the highest level of everybody else, and it was highly competitive as well as fun. We fought and protected each other, but we all were looking out for number one.
That's so interesting, yeah.
With that in mind, Dad had to try to not allow one of us to get up too far out of balance and disturb the game. And I first character to get other characters. I hired an elf and a dwarf, and then I picked up a couple of sidekick magic users as apprentices, and I was probably the fifth level or sixth level when I started hiring people and adding on. I mean, regularly. So my guy started getting up in levels and proved that NPCs only get half experience when they're adventuring with you, unless you're doing an adventure with them as the primary character and you're not involved.
It's really interesting because I think that's one of the things that, like new, people learning the game in their 20s, like, find that really surprising, that they want it, like, they kind of want this one spotlight just on the one character. And, you know, when I run the classic game for new players, they kind of have this transition period where they realize, and it's right around fifth or sixth level, like you're saying, where they realize how useful that is to have, you know, other characters that they can rely on. And then they really get into it, I think. So I do think it's a really nice aspect of the old school game to make that possible.
And it's also a good way to pass on what were once prized items but aren't quite good enough anymore. So you stick them down into the lackey's hands. Here's a plus one sword. Here's a plus one shield.
You're
doing pretty cool. You're only second level.
And plus in a game, plus in a game where it's actually really easy to die, it's good to have this bench of characters that can step up if you do lose one of your characters. You've already got them half developed, which is really smart too. But that's the way we would play.
They could be involved in a rescue mission because we did rescue missions for people if somebody was turned stone and then the other players gang up and everybody tries to come. And Dad, of course, I was a mapper. So the maps I've made on an mission that something bad happened to me or somebody else, those maps weren't allowed.
Okay.
So you had to do it all from memory.
Great. That's great. How many mazes, like how many mazy type things did your dad run? Because sometimes we struggle with that, but like me and Paul and our friends, like how many like weirdo entangled mazy stuff did he run? Was that a common element?
Yes, it was a common element, and it got more and more difficult as you went down lower, as did the traps. So that's why slanting passages came into account, and why they're generally really long instead of just a. It's like going to a baseball park where it's real steep. Instead, it's a slow slant to try to fool you so that you don't know that you're another level and your maps get more screwed up that way. So mapping was very important. Rob Kuntz wasn't a big mapper, but he was, but he had a great recall. And he'd also try to stay to one direction, like he'd always be, and then north, west, north, but all possible. And he'd do something like that on an individual adventure. So he could always then go east and then south to try to work his way back.
Clever.
So there was sorts of things. And like I said, the Cone of Cold was a third level spell when I first created it.
Yeah.
And Dad made it a D4 plus one to make it slightly different than a D6 per level. And it didn't destroy magic items. I figured out that as long as you allowed the characters to thaw slowly or to fold before you start trying to rip stuff off. So it was real handy because I had a portable hole. So I would kill something, and if it seemed to have something and it was too large, I could always even just slash off, try to break some part of the box far enough away, hopefully that it doesn't shatter the whole thing, and throw, So we had assorted things.
I get that. That's really clever because obviously in the original game, it specifically says if you hit magic or coins or gems with a fireball or a lightning bolt, they're going to break. So that's a really clever shortcut around that. That's smart. Got it.
Yeah.
And that's why it became fifth?
Yes. And it was fourth for a long time. Okay. And then Dad said, heck with it. This is, we're making this fifth level. So that made it. I still love it, but it's not as special as it was. Of course, it's third or fourth level.
Great.
So our viewer Daniel Boggs is wondering if you held on to any of those maps, Ernie. Do you still have any of them kicking around, or are they lost into the ages?
Oh, they're lost to the ages, sadly.
Yeah.
Ages. Mostly,
I know. I personally, as a kid, was terrible at.
No.
Sorry. Go on, Ernie.
Mostly just moving and having different relationships that have allowed. Things, what do you got that stupid stuff for? Blah, blah, blah. I stepped away like most people do at a certain period and got involved in other things and then came back to gaming.
Personally, as an adult, I've had to repurchase a lot of the books I had as a kid because I was just not a responsible child with my things.
Well, besides that, I had a fire also back in 2013.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Right.
Yeah. I got some things and a few items I was able to get back. And even then I let them sit in a barn for a couple of years to let the smoke, it was almost all the smoke damage. And then was wiping with Simply Green. And my GaryCon poster, Welcome to GaryCon 4, that's my dad, the side plastic frame had melted on it. So I had to No. Take it to a printer and have them cut all that away and put another silly plastic frame around it, so it lost about 2 inches on the whole edge.
Wow.
But the picture survives, huh? You still have the...
Yeah,
the
picture survives.
That's great.
And a few other things. But yeah, I could have probably gotten more things, but you take a horrible morale throw.
Yeah.
When you see your world up in flames. I walked out of there with a pair of night shorts, a t-shirt, and my car keys and wallet.
That's a real gut check.
Wow.
That's a real scary story, yeah. That's a real gut check. Wow.
A dog
good for you for bouncing back.
Dog and a roommate too, but
yeah. Well,
if you'd been hit by an ice storm, it would have been a lot better.
Yes, it would have. No, an ice storm does, if you do it in the cubes, it does physical damage, but Dad would still have things after to do crashing blows. So that's why the cold is cold. Doesn't do that harsh weight damage. Okay.
You're right. So you were Tenser, right? So among the other firsts, I guess, is you were the official Gygaxian first magic user as Tenser. And so I guess that kind of has a funny history, is that you were finding ways to make Tenser actually work like a fighter. And I guess that's part of it. So Paul and I were just talking last week a whole bunch about why fighters have multiple attacks in classic D&D. And I said, so I guess you were partly responsible for fighters getting multiple attacks?
Well, we all were getting multiple attacks against one-hit die critters.
Yeah.
Their level of attacks, which is a carryover from chainmail. And then he started doing the 3-for-2 for fighters at 7th level and the 2-for-1 at 13th. And he was just really frightened that as Tenser, I was creating more and more power that was just... He's still, to his dying day, my dad thought that the magic user was the most powerful class. And the experience points were that much more for levels. I went to the D4. Because, I would just fight. I just didn't have armor. That was the only thing. But as soon as I'd done whatever spells I had, I'd be in there with the staffs fighting it next to my elf and my dwarf. And well, that was for the solo adventures. And other adventures, it would be like Rob Koontz and Terry Koontz a lot, a lot of other people. But those were the original gamers. Terry was probably in about 30% of the games, and Rob was at 80%.
Cool. So we've seen. Sorry, Paul. Who's the other guy you gave the book to? All of a sudden, I'm drawn a blank.
Tim Kask and Frank Mentzer.
Right. So we've seen Tim Kask say, like you just said, that your father really didn't like magic users. But on the other hand, he himself ran Mordenkainen, right? Was that his own game?
No. Okay. Urag was his primary character, the fighter.
Oh, okay.
Mordenkainen was his lackey, and so was Bigby.
Really?
So Mordenkainen wasn't his primary character. Urag, the fighter. Hmm. And then when things would get tough. But as the adventurer, he ended up being a core of like 4 guys always going on adventures. So really? Which one was his main? Urag was the first one.
You know, it's and interesting Felnirith, because, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just said Urag and Felnirith were his 2 fighters, and Mordenkainen and Bigby were his users. And I think he had a Sigby who was a cleric.
Yeah.
He was always having fun with names.
Interesting. You know, so obviously we understand that, it's a business and, Wizards of the Coast, makes productions with all those characters that you guys came up with. And I guess I was talking to some guys that still run Greyhawk games and, they're understandably a little bit irritated that those things are now available on the DMs Guild site for anybody to use. Except that you're not, and yet at the same time, you're not allowed to place them in Greyhawk anymore. And so obviously the funny thing is they have all kinds of products they've developed with Mordenkainen on it, and very few people know about Urag anymore. So that's, I myself was confused about that. That's fascinating that the relationship was the other way around.
Tenser, I never went on higher than 14th level. All this. That was when I retired him.
Yeah.
Okay, I had the magic user's crown. I was really 13th level. The crown gave another level, but the damn crown made me have to get off the neutral fence and either go good or evil.
Okay.
So this crown gave all kinds of powers, like a 15% magic resistance, automatic level gain, unlimited self-teleportation safely, probably something else. But anyway, this was this really cool thing that I fought really hard and competed against Rob Koontz. Rob was trying to find this to give it to an evil wizard who was going to give him a bunch of other cool things that he could use. And Rob started. Rob was the first hunter, and then I suddenly found out, well, what's happening? Why is all this money going on and all this? So I put out my own scouts, and then it became a contest between us to try to find this art.
Let me ask this. The so in the published version of the Isle of the Ape, right, adventure,
yeah.
It starts off with like a fully, I think, page and a half monologue from Tenser. Right. So when I've delivered that, like I have to spend about 20 minutes giving this monologue, trying to find the voice of Tenser. Did you actually play through the Isle of Ape yourself? Why was that? Did you actually get involved with that?
Yes, I was there. And so was Jim Ward. He was with me and he was lower level. His character was Bombadil. But I don't remember the Isle of the Ape fondly because I think I'd found the treasure. I had an earth elemental tearing up underneath the ground where the girl would be strapped as the sacrifice.
Okay.
And it's like didn't find it or couldn't get in there and all this. I used my only wish to get us all out of it.
Oh, okay. It's a punishing adventure. It's a totally punishing adventure. And, like, the very first thing that happens is you get jumped, like, by 200 natives with giant gorillas, right? Is that, like, when I ran it, I was like, I don't even know how to run this.
I don't remember any giant gorillas.
Okay. There are giant gorillas.
Well, I knew there was one.
Right.
There was one King Kong, of course. Right. And Tyrannosaurus Rexes and other nasty things.
Right. It's a great adventure, but punishing. My the party that I ran through it was they were wiped out.
I think we did there might even been another guy there. I don't know if it was Don K or what, but somebody I think got up and levitated. So there was arrows and spears coming at him and there was lightning bolts coming down at people and Dad had of course lightning bolts and things throwing in other large critters.
Great.
Great.
So Ernie, you've described some of these games where it's just you, where you're kind of playing solo, right? And then some other games with other folks. And I'm kind of curious. And one of our viewers is asking the same question of like, how many people did you typically have around the table? How often was it just you and Dad versus like a big group? And how big did that group get when it was a big group?
Well. Now, playing with Dad, the groups didn't get as large. I don't think they ever got more than, say, like 8, 10 people. Where I've run games on all the time with 13 to 22 people. But I've been running games generally as part of a hobby shop or a convention rather than my even in personal games now, it's hard to turn away anybody that wants to play. So I have to just pick and choose.
Yeah.
Then we generally get a guest coming in.
I totally wanted to ask about that because, so, you know, we've seen, the number of players thing as we've seen, in the books and your dad writing about having as many as up into the 20s. Paul and I have played in a game with Bill Webb where we had 23 people one night, 27. I've gotten up as much as 14 myself. And there's a lot of younger people that just don't believe that's even possible. They just can't imagine that that's even possible. Do you do anything different when you're running a big group with like 22 people?
Well, generally you need somebody to be the general caller. He can get the party call. He can input from everybody else. And then when it's actual combat, I do an initiative system where I have everybody roll a 6-sided die and then they add any of their dexterity benefits. So if you've got an 18 dexterity, you've got a plus three, I think it could be to your initiative. So then I go in, it's just plus three. I go, okay, now everybody. And I say, if you have the same number as somebody else, have it in your head what you're going to do, and then say it, because you can't react to George's efforts if you're Paul. And then we just go right on the thing. So it becomes kind of like a metronome. Okay, 8, 7, 6. Okay, we start doing the sixes. Okay, and then, okay, the monsters have a 5. But for the monsters, I generally do it all as a group. So if there's a particularly special boss fiend, bad guy, whatever, he might get something, and his lackeys will get a different initiative. So that's how you try to do that. Split parties are very hard to do. I've done it in large groups. So boy, is that painful. But if somebody's sweeping around to do a motion or something like that, well, that's okay.
Yeah.
And it's always fun to take somebody off to the side if they grab something, even if it's doing nothing. But you take a little bit of time and talk to them. So when you come back, the other people think maybe they're taking over or they're trying to steal something. It's Discord at the same time. And your job is to make it fun. You're not trying to party kill stuff is garbage. That's that's on the shirt there.
I
failed as well as they. You know, if I haven't somehow shared the game well enough where they're learning something and they have a chance, there has to be an element of danger. And you know, level losses. Oh my god. Steal levels, of course. That's something that a lot of people don't understand. You know, they're highly feared. That's why fireballs just almost always go off when you see a bunch of undead. Doesn't matter if right, you know, material stuff. Get rid of these guys before they die.
I get that. I still use that, and I feel like I agree with you. It's important to have like a real element of risk. And you know, my games tend to wind up being horror games, even if I don't want them to, particularly when the level draining undead come out. So I like having them part of the game. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's,
I mean, I feel like, that 8 to 10 players is, even like most, you know, younger players these days are saying that that's really big, right? Like I feel like more often I'm seeing 4 or 6 players at the table. 8 to 10 is a lot of people to juggle.
What point do you feel like you need the caller to come in? Like, because it's funny because, I mean, I've been playing for a whole bunch of years, and then I just came to this same realization that there's a particular switchover point where you need the caller. Like, at what point do you really feel like you need the caller?
When you stop having fun and everybody's talking at the same time, so there is no magic number. It's when the people themselves are starting to make this a chore rather than a fun activity.
I should okay. So my personality tends to be I want a number, but that's probably better advice.
Oh dear.
What rule set do you play with? Do you play with like advanced rules, or do you play with like the original rule book?
Advanced first edition. A few things. I still have gems in the old fashioned method where they go up on a 1 and they go down on a 6 when you get a pool of say 20 gems that are base 50 gold pieces. And it's possible that one of them could be 100,000 or more. Very unlikely. But you just keep on re-rolling. On a 1 it goes up and you roll again. Oh, but there's a flaw here on a 6. So then as soon as you roll something that is 2 through 5, that gem is set aside. It's now has its value established. And that makes it a lot of fun for the players that say, okay, you get 4 gems, you get 5, and then you start getting polished up and looking to see if you somehow struck it rich and got the big experience point payoff. Because the first edition, it's money is the primary experience point reward.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And it's an interesting point about, you know, the fact that you're mixing and matching at least a couple things from what some people would consider to be different editions. And certainly, you know, most of us growing up, me and Paul kind of used a little bit of a mishmash of different editions. And I think I saw a little while ago Frank Metzer saying they're totally one continuous game. Like, in your opinion, is the first advanced game just basically a continuation of what came before it, or do you think it's like a really radical break?
It was a continuation of the original D&D.
Gotcha. So you feel like you could take earlier stuff and just be using it all the same game?
Oh, sure. The same dungeon. My dungeon's from 1978. Okay, right. It's called the Hobbit Shot Dungeon, and this is a replication of the Hobbit Shot Dungeon. I'll just try to.
Yeah. I totally wanted to see this.
Like the second level.
Great.
Third level.
Great.
All these have been increased by 6 times. Okay. Third level. So you see you get more stone as you're down deeper.
Yeah. Okay.
Otherwise the levels are with thin walls.
Yep, yep.
You start
Great.
And then for the fifth level, we use the geomorphs that I used to work on, the dungeon geomorphs.
Great.
Right.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then for the sixth level, I took a Luzaki piece of graph paper that was 10 squares to the inch. That was about 4 feet by 3 feet. And that was my whole sixth level. Great. And that the sixth level was basically a 6 through 12 for difficulty.
Okay. Now you realize there's going to be some of our viewers that are going to take screenshots of what you just put up and then take Photoshop and be spending like about 1,000 man hours trying to perfectly recreate what you just showed.
Well, you know what else will happen though is that, like I said, we've got each one of these levels. Benoit Pouar, who is a partner of mine with GP Adventures, has taken these and taken the core of them and made it like 6 times larger. And he is an incredible, incredible map maker. He is the best freehand map maker I know, cartographer. This is what he did for Gygax number 3.
Wow. That's lovely. And, that's really lovely, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the top level of the Memorial Tomb. It's some minor modifications. And then there's a second level, and a third, the fourth, chaos. And that's all part of the Kickstarter that's finally, very late, getting out. And a lot of that is due to a good friend of mine and a good friend of my father's, Stephen Schnaltz with Trollord Games. So once this Kickstarter is officially filled, there's going to be all kinds of people getting in and buying as a backer. Phil, and if we've got a kind of equivalent to World of Greyhawk, our world setting, and then Ben does work with individual hexes, trying to show how you can go as detailed as you want to. Because my dad, a lot of the Greyhawk things, if you would pick it up now, it would be mostly 4 ogres, hidden treasure here in a club, that kind of thing, and then he makes them come alive and fills them. And he would say fireball line, say inside of the club or something like that, you know, so if you'd have to somehow find, not only did you have to vanquish the foe, but you had to find the hidden treasure. But on any sort of module you'd buy, of course, you need a lot more detail than that. A page instead of a paragraph.
Yeah, I think we can see the evolution of like some really, really early documents and having to get, you know, built up for people that aren't as savant at DMing as you and your father were. And sometimes that can be a bit of a struggle. So do you think that like most of what your father was doing was like improvised on the fly? And do you do it the same way?
I do a great deal of improvisation involving, I'm trying to keep it fun, challenging, especially if they're getting something too easy or if something's too hard, then you try to leave some sort of other thing or you start rolling for a a wandering monster to come in, and even though it's not necessarily a rescue, it's something to throw something in the works to change things so that potentially they could pull out and escape, even though they've wasted resources and possibly taken a bunch of damage. But there'd be hope.
Great.
You know, so yes, I definitely don't just read off a book when I'm dungeon mastering by any means. And I don't expect anybody else to. The rules are just guidelines. They're intelligent guidelines. They've been play tested a lot. But if it doesn't work for you and your people, then change it to something that does. But allow new people to come in or whatever else to understand that you have these deviations from the new norm. And the best test of that will be if people still want to come and play. Once you start losing players, then you're too lost in your own world instead of sharing an experience with them.
I like that as a kind of market research perspective towards your game.
I think that's really great advice, honestly, and that's stuff that really resonates, I think, with both Dan and I. That's certainly how we run our games. Before we gloss over it, though, I really want to quickly touch again. You were mentioning your Kickstarter, which I believe is the Marmorial Tome Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And just for the sake of our viewers, could you tell us, like, what's the status of that? If somebody had never heard of it, is it something that they can still find somewhere?
Well, you can find anything you need with the Trollord games, people. And
great.
At this status, everybody's got is a PDF of the beta version, meaning that right now all the Kickstarter people are getting a chance to give some instant returns, saying you've got a typo on page 4, paragraph 3, and this and that, or this chart doesn't make sense somehow or whatever. So they're getting before this all gets polished up and printed, but. Like I said, I can't say highly enough. Well, Stephen Chanel and Trollords used to deal with my dad's own materials once TSR was stolen from him, and after TSR then went on to kill Game Designers Workshop that Dad was working with. It was just, you know, there was a definite hate. Lorraine Williams probably has a special level of hell for her.
That was a tense time for all of us, I think. And so your Kickstarter for Marmorial Tome, I guess that's based on the first level. It's an expansion of the first level of the Dungeon Hobby Shop, yeah. Right? So you have more to come. So after this, there's more to go.
It's in the Dungeon Hobby Shop. No, it was only made for Gygax Magazine because Jason Elliott said, could you do something, you know, really special? Because there was games inside a Dragon magazine, and this is the new Dragon in all respects. So can we somehow, and I said, of course. So I got Ben and I together. I said, let's stop working on this thing that we've been working on for 3 or 4 years, the Dungeon Hobby Shop, the same world. Let's make an individual scenario so that it can be the centerfold. So instead of pretty girls, if you're a good gamer geek, you have...
And your Kickstarter has been super successful too, right? Your original goal was like 20K, and it's up over 120K contributions now, right?
Well, yes, it was, and most of that, almost half of that money's been spent on art and other things. But I'm still holding on to about 78,000 or whatever else for printing, maybe about 76 now. For another editor with Steven. I threw them some chump change just for spending all this time and rescuing us.
That seems wise. That seems wise to treat your henchmen well, I think.
Yeah. he's more than a henchman. He's a lifetime friend. I was at his very first convention, TrollCon 1 down in Little Rock, Arkansas, as a guest of honor back in 2001. That's when we originally did the Lost City of Gaxmore. That's another project that's been done through Trollords, and that was something that I did with a prisoner in the Florida State prison system. He'd been a car thief that somehow did an escape attempt, and he did another escape attempt and injured a guard, so he was stuck in solitary 23 hours in, 1 hour out in a cage.
Wow. Otherwise, holy moly.
Had a lot of time. Yeah, so we worked a little bit on that. Then I got my brother involved in it. Then my dad read through it because he was still alive. And so it was obviously started around 2007 or so. But I took this and said, okay, instead of doing these solo snail mail adventures with this one guy, I said, why don't we start sharing gaming ideas that I can then use with the kids at the Game Guild? The kids. These kids are now 40-something. But, right. I mean, then they were teenage boys play. And they're good kids, too. And I still love to play games with them. And lots of them now are running games with their children. That's what's fantastic, is to see it be passed generation to generation. And the love.
Totally two, agree.
It's not only sons. Yeah. That's the only good, that's a really good thing about modern D&D. I don't like it as much in many ways, but somehow it seems to have appealed to the feminine psyche. And God bless. Let everybody play.
Yeah. Well put.
So I'm losing my tangent. What would you like me to talk about? The Gygax magazine, Memorial Tomb, the Gaxmore stuff.
Actually,
we just did a fifth edition of Lost City of Gaxmore, which also did over $100,000. And wow. It's looking beautiful. And I've got a giant map that's like 5 feet long, canvas map done by Alyssa Farndon. And my brother is showing it. I haven't pulled it out of the tube yet because I'm going to set it up at my fiance's house. It looks like we're going to be moving to her big house, and this will be a rental or something for somebody. Maybe it'll be a one day at a time thing for people to be able to rent and then come over and play.
That's awesome.
Try it in that way.
That's awesome.
Geneva and stay there.
Now, one thing you just mentioned about, like, actually that I know Paul totally was really eager to hear about was, you know, you have friends and they've moved away. And for some of us, we used to have to play by mail, right? Nowadays, yeah. We do have some extra tools, and like a bunch of us have just jumped into, you know, playing online just in the last couple of months. Now, of course, GaryCon this year had to go virtual. How much virtual stuff did you do for GaryCon this year?
Zero.
Okay.
I was involved in the setup with the concept. Said, go, great. I'm inviting people over to my house. And we're going to do a mini GaryCon.
Okay.
So it didn't, it shrank down to just being four guests.
Okay.
Tom Wong and three others. And I was able to give him the trophy for the E. Gary Gygax Award for this year for outstanding, you know, game creation. And that's on a video as well. That's on the GaryCon site as well as, I think, on my site.
Cool.
That's great. I mean, I'm glad, really glad you guys were able to do something online there. I know the timing of GaryCon was just like right in the crosshairs of the current situation. So, really kudos to you for shifting and doing something with folks. Do you have any plans for doing other further virtual stuff, or is your eyes now on a live GaryCon next March?
Oh, it's going to be definitely a live GaryCon next March. And also, we've really topped out on size. So the people that have that are willing, those people that bought tickets last year aren't getting their full refund unless they really, really insist. Otherwise, they're getting like half credit towards this next year. And they're also getting guaranteed positioning in. So it'll be almost like buying stadium tickets to an event where you'll be grandfathered in for getting all the premier stuff. And then if you still want to come in with day passes or whatever, you can. But the reason for this is that we've come to a decision that Luke could change. He's like the guy in charge. But we all have input, the children. And he has to do all the work, too. Let's put that where it's important.
Always good to have someone to do all the work.
Lake Geneva is Gary Con. It's TSR. It's Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And there'll be a slight poll, of course, that there's that somewhere in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, you know, St. Paul. But otherwise, this and we're and finally our town is coming together. The local Geneva Lakes Museum now has a TSR Gary Gygax room that they're getting ready to open with a big gaming table and everything. You'll actually be able to play. 723 William Street, the very first building that we bought as a company, Gary and Brian Bloom, and had it as the Dungeon Hobby Shop in the bottom area, the shipping department in the kitchen. The basement was the storage for all the TSR product, except for a warehouse or two. Upstairs was the art department. Gary, early on, Tim Kask came in with a Dragon magazine, which had first been Strategic Review. Brian had an office. Kevin, we had the accountants down there. My mom had the advertising agency, Powell Associates. All that worked out of that one house. So that's going to be a gaming museum mecca place to come to. All right? And Justin Lanasa, I set up. He's bought it, and he's got Jeff Leeson's going to be living upstairs with his kiddies. And working on it and being like the administrator, and we're all going to have fun there. Great. There'll be a spot where you can come.
That's great. Then
he's trying to talk about it, having DMs where you pay for. You can come in and just pay a certain amount, and then you get food and beverage, and you can play there. There'll be like a room maybe that you can rent to stay there if you want to then come down and play. There'll be if you want to have a Jim Ward and Ernie Gygax. Frank Mentzer or somebody else run a game, then you'll pay a slightly higher price, but you'll be there and it'll be an organized game. It's not just coming up there and say, hey, call Ernie and bring him over. But, you know, with planning and whatever else, an organized event can be held there. Where I originally played with the 22 Sailors and as all this first level, and they went into my dungeon just after Wonder Woman was over. We'd watch Wonder Woman and shut down the store. I had a TV in there. And then after that, because all of us like to watch Wonder Woman.
That's great. And we're talking the original That's Linda great. Carter version, just to be
clear.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, right. Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. And after watching her bounce.
Dan, it sounds like there's a... Sounds like definitely a location that the Wandering Dams are going to have to wander to in the future when we're allowed out of our houses again.
That is a great point. I think that's going to be really highly in demand, and we're going to try to be first in line.
Right. Sounds good. I happen to be involved with that. So I'll let Justin know too.
That's great.
He's a good guy.
All right. We have the hookup now, Dan.
And, that was the whole point, Paul.
Not only does he have this place, but he has a Museum of the Unusual in I think it's North Carolina, which is basically the same thing as Ripley's Believe It or Not, with a lot of horror stuff and other already. And a tattoo shop. So this man knows business, and he's moving into this right now.
That's great. That's fantastic. Boy, that's great. I think you'll have a lot of customers with that. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Phil.
Just to circle back though, I'm curious. In the meantime, between sort of now and whenever this madness ends, are you doing any online gaming, or is there any stuff that you're planning to do virtually?
Myself, no. When it comes to online gaming, I've allowed where I have somebody at my table, and they can have a phone or a laptop or something. With another player somewhere else, and they can talk, so they'll be both at my table, but only one will be actually there talking to me, and they will be talking to me, not the guy on the screen.
Gotcha.
So, you know, someone will say, okay, Jim, tell him that I want to do this, I want to do that. And then you'll say, okay, Frank wants to do, you know, fireball here. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, what's his initiative role, etc. So I try to keep that a real person involved at my table as well, so that we can have a control.
Right.
And then I can deal with maybe five people live and five online or something like that. But it does, you have a smaller group if you have people online, I think. There's just too much back and forth discussion.
I think we found that. The you know, it's funny because I guess I've heard Mike Marner talk about some games where your father would hide himself behind his filing cabinet so you couldn't actually see him while he ran a game. So you're kind of back at this, like you're not actually, you don't even need to visibly see one of the players, and that's perfectly fine.
It, when we ran some games in the basement, which would be more of a larger group, those of us that were playing were on the side where my dad's shoe repair used to be, and before that, the sand table. But the still part of that workbench existed in between, and Dad and Rob, because that's when they rebooted Greyhawk. And that's when Rob retired Robilar and I retired Tensor, then I got to start with a new character, Erak, and another wizard. And then at some point, when I was doing a solo adventure with Erak, I was up to 6th level, my dad had me start on the pool level because I was 2 hours late for going to bed for school, and my mom was just yelling at him and me constantly, you know. So that tells you I was a kid. I was still a kid. And so my dad had my character, you know, die there, which was just horrible. It was crying and going to bed. And he said, "All your items will still be here, and they'll be here if you ever can find it again." But he said, "I'm sorry, Ernie, you took my maps," and he tore them up because your maps are down here or stuck them in a whatever. It was like, oh, it was a horrible night. But then later on, I started with Erak's cousin, so that meant I still had access to the gold and whatever I still had stored at his room. And then I was able to work him up to about the same level with a couple other guys and get my shit back. Most of it. Other players stole some of my other items too. But I had a Horn of a Hollis Silver, I remember, a crystal ball, I think, some other things. So
that would make an impression. I would say I would remember that for forever.
Yeah.
That's rough.
I love the character names. We have a random question from one of our viewers that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. You know, hearing a lot of names here with built-in puns or acronym names. Do you have a personal favorite, a name that was used in D&D in the early days that is clearly a wink or a pun for the folks, the players?
A lot of them would be like Heward's Mystical Organ was my cousin Hugh Burdick, who built church organs and tuned and did stuff with pianos and organs since he was just a little kid. That was his whole career. Mm. That and somehow getting lost in Scientology. But there was also and all the tensor spells that were made for me, like the tensor's floating disc. I didn't create that spell. It was me taking someone who had been killed, and I still just took all the extra bags we could, and I loaded them up with treasure, and was dragging them along with another character or whatever else, because I wouldn't even copper pieces. So the idea is that we were carrying the gold on us, and then we had the lesser stuff, but we were just trying to get every little bit of everything. But I'll tie have to drop the body for a while and run. And then hopefully you can come back and get some treasure. But the idea is that my greed, I've always been, you know, looking for that almighty experience point and all the better, the magic items. God, I love magic items. Jim Ward too. He loves his magic.
That's great. That's great. You've heard it here first. The original Tensor's floating disc was a corpse being dragged on the ground full of treasure. That's fantastic.
If we even had a stone statue we were taking, if somebody got turned to stone, we would still try to drape stuff on them if we had, you know, and since we already had this encumbrance.
The last time I played with Paul, there was a situation with petrified statues where we had a lot of trouble. That would have helped us out a lot, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So before it gets too late, I guess I don't want to miss right before we started here, Ernie, you were talking about the other thing that's happening in Lake Geneva is the Geek Nation tours, right?
Absolutely. The Geek Nation tour, we did one last year, and this is called the RPG, I believe. And it's by Terrace Cassidy, and it's Geek Nation Tours. And I put it on my Facebook page a few times. But the Geek Nation Tours is something where he arranges and picks you up from the airport, shuttles you to Lake Geneva, and you then stay overnight for weeks, and you game every day and visit places and get tours. So you're going to be at Horticultural Hall, where Gen Con started. You're going to be at gaming at 330 Center Street with me, doing Dungeon Hobby Shop, Dungeon, or whatever else I pull out at the time that I feel like. At the Horticultural Hall, we still see, we generally do a Tomb of Horrors for one day, and just to try to keep in the spirit with my dad. Right. And then, as I said, we're at 123 William Street. We go out and we look at the TSR buildings in Sheridan Springs. My dad was born. We, you know, check, we see where the building downtown that's now the Landmark Center, which was TSR after 723 William Street on Main and Broad Street. You can't get more downtown than that. A building's been around since the 1800s. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful time where you're not a spot to stay, but he throws dinner. We go out and eat one or two nights at local restaurants where my dad and all of us used to go. It's just immersing yourself in Lake Geneva gaming. And it's the Geek Nation Tours, and I can't say enough about it. And it's not only myself. It's Jim Ward is involved, Jeff Leeson, who was part of the Lost Shrine of Motion. And last year, Tom Womp. I'm not sure if Tom's coming back to do this. He's a local, and I do a lot of gaming with Tom. But no matter what, it's a good crew. It's a fair amount of coin. It's like $3,600, and if you plus whatever your flight is, and
but how many days is it? How many days does it last?
Well, it's like 6 days, but it's like 5 days of gaming.
Okay, great.
It's like, you know, one day is just getting you here,
right?
And setting things up and introducing everybody to each other. But yeah, even dinner time is this big table where all of you sit together and talk about gaming for the day and all that.
That sounds really amazing.
Yeah, sounds super fun.
We're hoping to do this again in November, but it's all important time whether we can get enough people to still throw out the coin and have the time and to be able to have the time to be able to do it after a lot of people have just had nothing but time on. But we're going to try to do it in November, yeah. And we're talking about doing it in spring, potentially the week after GaryCon. So that Tuesday, right after GaryCon, some people that really want to double dip could fly in with the GaryCon to stay an extra night or two. And then just go right into this gaming camp, and then behold, they'll have like a 2 week binge.
That sounds great.
And I always have at least 2 weeks around GaryCon. People start coming in at least a week early, and we start gaming all the time. So GaryCon is wonderful. Oh, GaryCon! We should bring up GaryCon. What a shame! Shame on me. That's a fantastic time. So again, we're starting to fill up to mass quantities, but it's just grand. It's like the old Horticultural Hall and Legion Hall gaming when we the early Gen Cons.
Awesome. So that's fantastic.
So yeah, I even run one other thing, but it's real small. At the end of June, I'll hopefully be able to the Ronald Donald Pazier Con. What that is, we get together at my fiance's house, Donna Giovanni, and Robert is a fellow who tried to get into a GaryCon game with me. He's in a wheelchair, and he can't do anything but move his head, okay, and talk. And yet, Dungeons and Dragons has allowed him to have a life. He's 40 years old now, okay? He's never known, you know, hugging and kissing a girl or any, you know, goddamn. So when I couldn't let this guy come into my game, it was just too crowded. I had already 18 people in the room was stuffed. I said, we're going to get together and game again. Well, we've done that twice. And he's now come to Lake Geneva That's for great. Several days and other people I invite. We have about maybe up to 13 people each day. And he's a constant. And it's just fantastic to sit around in the sunshine and what and just and game, and then we come in and I don't know. It's just another wonderful thing. It's so limited. I probably should bring it up, but it's just that's what D&D brings. It allows people that have issues, physical, mental, whatever else, to somehow have an escape to stimulate the brain and also to get over problems. So, Dungeons & Dragons has been very good to me, and it started with wargaming and miniatures gaming with Airfix miniatures and sand tables, and it's become. It's been part of my life. As you pointed out, I literally grabbed on a card table a Stalingrad SS Panzer Division and chewed it. My dad had to make a new counter to put on the table. Okay. So I cut my teeth on gaming.
That's a great story. That's a great story. And I agree that, I mean, for many of us, you know, whether our challenges are small or large, like many of us have had times in our life where we needed that as an entryway to connect to other people that, you know, that wasn't happening up until that time. So I think that we all agree with you that we're glad to have, you know, for many of us this in our life. And thank you for helping to evolve it and develop it, Ernie.
Well, it was all fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the best kind of job to have. I worked on the Monster and Treasure lists as a kid in high school. I worked on the Geomorphs. I shipped out everybody's Empire of the Petal Thrones and original brown boxes. If Rob Koontz wasn't there, it was me doing it and all this. So before I became a hobby shop clerk working for Harry Koontz first, then Tom Wom, and then I ended up running the hobby shop, the mail order, Gen Con, and the Art Role Playing Game Association. At one time, I had 22 employees at TSR. I was a executive vice president in charge of consumer services and made a 22% profit margin overall on every dollar spent. That was grand. Not only was I a showcase, but we returned money to the fold.
Nice. You also came up with the Game Wizards tagline, right? So, you know, back in the day, TSR, you came up with the Game Wizards tagline, right?
Yes, because my dad had said that Brian was talking to him and they thought the Lizard Man was just too war game. Mm-hmm. So they needed, and I said, well, and now in those days there was a toy company called Cody and they had a cricket. So I said, Cody has a cricket. I said, we are playing a fantasy game. We're the Game Wizards. And then, so my dad said, stand the clock, so put your feet on my desk. Here's a glass of Courvoisier. And here's a cigar. Now you've just done an executive kind of thing. Welcome to the club. And I got to bask in some glory. I got minimum wage for 2 hours sitting drinking and smoking.
We can all wish. We'll all wish for that.
I know, but still, you know. In those days, nobody was making good money yet. You know, Tim Kask was the first hired employee to collect money. But then after that, my dad was getting some. When my dad was doing this, we were on food stamps. In those days, food stamps meant paying in what you could afford to get more dollars in food.
Great. Yep. Understood. Understood.
Yeah. It was hard as a kid. Going to the grocery store or whatever else and having people look down their nose at you like, oh, look at this. They're getting free stuff, you know. Later on, a lot of those same people suddenly were kissing, you know, my dad's feet, whatever else. And he was a board member at the local bank and had over 300 employees at TSR. Suddenly it was a... Oh, you've changed so much. It's like a W.C. Fields film where the wife is always nagging at him and yelling. Yeah. You're a rotten guy. And at the end, when he becomes rich, he's such a changed man. Oh, I love him so much. You know, and he's doing the same stuff. He's now just wearing better clothes.
I think you can tell the real quality of a person if their treatment of somebody changes based on their place in life, right? You could that's a real solid tell. And I guess your family has gotten to experience that real distinctly.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
Well, Paul, so I want to talk with Ernie for like hour, like all day long, but we should probably hold to our normal show schedule, man, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We're gonna have to wrap it up here.
If you want to stay on,
so thanks everyone for joining us.
All right,
And I hope we can have you back sometime, Ernie. You think that that can happen in the future when you have another project or something?
Sure.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Cool. Awesome. So we'll just tell our viewers here, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook. And we're by the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites.
If I could put in one more thing.
Likewise, you can listen.
Facebook is public for everybody. And there's tons and tons and tons of photo albums of old TSR gaming and even current gaming and things going on, as well as my personal life with my pets and my girl and whatever. But there's a lot of good reference material for anybody who's interested in the history of Dungeons and Dragons in particular, and then all sorts of other gaming in general.
I agree. I follow Ernie's page myself, and it's really great. You should watch that.
Yeah, so you should go, definitely advise our listeners and viewers, go go check it out. Look up Ernie Gygax on Facebook, and apparently you'll find quite a lot.
Yep, Ernest Gary Gygax.
You can also catch our show in audio-only podcast format if you want. That's available on our website at wanderingdms.com, as well as various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcast. If you are listening to this show on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
And I got to give a thanks to our patrons who support our show. If you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, where you can support this show and other shows that we do. Enormous thanks to Ernie today. Thank you so much for coming on. And we hope that you will look, our viewers and listeners will look for the Memorial Tomb Project and the Lost City of Gaxmoor. That's at Troll Lord Games. I'll point out that, you know, you do have stretch goals that you have reached, that there's 5th edition conversions and a whole bunch of other additions for your Memorial Tomb Project. Look for Ernie Gygax on Facebook, really easy to find there. And also look for the upcoming Geek Nation tours, all kinds of exciting stuff in the Lake Geneva area. So thank you to Ernie. We hope they'll have you on again. Remember that we are live every Sunday with the talk show here, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
All right. Thank you.
We'll see you then.
Bye.